I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Podcast like it's 1999. Podcast like it.
You want a podcast like it? Podcast like it's 1999.
Podcast like it. Just podcast like it. Podcast like it's 1999. Podcast like it.
You want a podcast like it? 1999.
Welcome to Podcast Like It's 1999. I'm your host, Phyllis Gove, and we're going to do another one of those two-episode episodes. The first is going to be with Meg Masters. She works in publicity over at Netflix. She used to be a reporter for E! She was on for, I think, The Love Bug a few weeks ago, and we're going to talk about Help for the Lovelorn, the, infamous Twilight Zone episode that they did of Felicity. It actually aired in the year 2000, but I don't give a shit. I wanted to talk about it, and it was only like 2 or 3 weeks into 2000, so I'm just I make the rules, so we're gonna talk about it. But it's a tremendous episode, and if you have not seen Felicity, even if you just want to watch it in a vacuum, I highly recommend watching the Twilight Zone episode. It is it's really, really, really tremendous. And Meg and I talk about that. We get into the details of how it mirrors the original television show and the episode that it's let's say nodding to. But it's a great episode. And then after that, I have an interview, or I was able to interview Robert Benedict, who plays Richard on Felicity, and we talk about his experiences and what that was like. So stick around for that after my episode with Meg Masters. Welcome to Podcast Like It's 1999. I'm your host, Phyllis Gove. And with us today, again, thankfully, for a special bonus episode, since this episode didn't air in 1999, is Meg Masters, a critic reporter. We used to be a critic reporter at E! And TV Line before moving to Netflix in publicity. She was here a couple weeks ago for The Love Bug, and thankfully she knows lots about The Twilight Zone, which will help me since I don't know a ton about it. This episode is too good to not talk about. It was one of those things where it's on the cusp. It's literally one episode outside of 1999. So I make the rules and I want to talk about this episode. So we're going to talk about it. And it's just so good. It's called Help for the Lovelorn. It aired on January 23rd. 2000. It was written by J.J. Abrams, directed by Lamont Johnson, who was a former Twilight Zone director. He directed about 6 or 7 episodes of the original show. What do you think of this episode, Meg?
It's so good and better than I remember. And probably just again, the same as going back and watching the last episode. It's better as an adult. I just feel like you can relate to it more. The themes are really kind of heavily forced upon the viewer, and it does tie back to the show, even though it's a standalone episode, obviously. But I don't know. It did justice to Twilight Zone. And you said you don't know a ton about that, but
I've seen a handful of episodes.
Have you seen this episode of the Twilight Zone?
I have not seen the one that they're riffing on.
Oh my gosh. Okay. So I just rewatched it. I mean, they, by the time they're in the box in the Felicity episode, or they wake up in that area, that is almost, I mean, there's like word for word dialogue that is pulled from, and like the stretching and thing. I don't know. I just think they, it was just such like a lovely little, like paying homage to the Twilight Zone.
It's a huge love letter. You know, it's one of those things where, I was watching this episode thinking a lot of things, but one of the bigger things was they don't do this anymore. We don't do standalone episodes, really. I mean, you'll have the occasional bottle episode, which is done for production purposes less than anything else, where, and for those who don't know what a bottle episode is, it's essentially when you've spent too much money and you need to essentially stay on your standing sets. You need to bottle, quote unquote, the episode so that it's cheaper to make, so that you can take the money that's being saved on that episode and afford it to the episodes that come after it. So you'll have those still because budgetarily they still happen, but you don't have, you know, your musical episode from Buffy. I mean, I guess Grey's Anatomy did a musical episode too. If you could see the look on Meg's face as I mentioned the musical episode. But you know what I'm saying? Like, it just, and I think part of it has to do with the fact that, I mean, broadcast TV isn't what it used to be. Doesn't have the viewership that it has or had. And I think that because episode orders have shrunk in the cable and streaming space, people don't want to quote unquote burn an episode on something like this. It makes it a bit of a relic and such a lovely thing that I miss.
This is exactly what I said because I was rewatching it again last night, and I truly, it started and I thought, I can't think of the last time someone just did these like standalone episodes, which I feel like nowadays fandoms would probably reject it almost. I don't know. I just think they would not love something like this today, which is sad because I think this is just such a, it's a nice little, just a little treat in the middle of something. What I will say is I did not remember this was as early as season two. I remembered this as something that like ended the series almost, like as part of time traveling stuff. Yeah, which, you know, I was very young when I watched the show originally. True. And yeah, I just, I couldn't believe not only that it was so early, but it's like season two, the hair, the backlash. Yeah. I don't know how like the production timeline in the writer's room went. I have to imagine they were probably they'd maybe written a draft of this by the time this was, I don't know, but it just felt like, whoa, extra risky during a season two when things were already so kind of hair gate and ratings down. And
I agree. I mean, and it's crazy in a bunch of ways. It's crazy too, because I watched the first episode of 2000, which came after the finale, obviously in December, they did one episode, which they split into a two-parter, which has the strangest of to be continued at the end of it. It's essentially her dad and her sitting at a restaurant, and it's just like, tough times ahead, to be continued. And I'm like, what?
And wait, was a finale? Because I did that.
That was the premiere. Okay. That was the premiere of 2000, essentially. So like was January, whatever, 16th or something like that. But it's strange that, first of all, that they split it into a two-parter, which I can only assume the to be continued was because they knew this was coming up next week and they didn't want people to be like, what the fuck is going on? Mm-hmm. At the same time, it's a weird placement for this episode, to your point. You know, the show is, you know, It's on wobbly terrain. The hair stuff has happened. The ratings are down. And then they spend money on the set. Like, this is an expensive episode. It looks beautiful. When I was talking to Amanda Foreman about this episode, when I interviewed her, she said that the director was very old and very slow. And I think that's, again, like, that doesn't help you on budgeting. Like, that makes things more expensive when it takes longer to make stuff. So it's just one of those things where, to your point, it's a big swing and it's to go all in on something at a very strange time for this show.
And clearly just for the fun of it. I mean, it's literally just because JJ and probably Matt are fans of Twilight Zone.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I do think it made sense in the placement within the season, though.
Oh,
I know it's not part of the Twilight or the to be continued, but man, did it just like perfectly just fit right in between the Ben coming back and wanting to be with Felicity again and the Nolan Ruby stuff. I don't know. I just, again, like the smartest stuff. The show just did the smartest stuff and it made sense within it.
I could not agree with you more. It's watching it through the lens of, I mean, this is also part of the problem too, which is, you know, in 1989 or for this episode, very, very early 2000, you know, audiences just, they weren't as savvy to a certain degree. And I don't say that as a judgment, but I just think that the type of television people were watching back then was very specific. And as we've sort of discussed on this podcast and we'll continue to discuss, you know, this is the year that The Sopranos premieres, and the year that The West Wing premieres. And it's a real sort of fulcrum point for the television industry where you're seeing that moment where obviously broadcast is incredibly lucrative. It's the standard bearer, and this industry is holding on to it with every ounce of its being. How we're still holding on to it, even with two other types of distribution that exist. And I think that if you watch this show through that prism, you're not going to get the metatextuality. You're not going to necessarily get all the commentary that exists within it. Mm-hmm. Basically, what I'm saying is it's kind of too smart for its audience is unfortunately the case.
It is. I agree completely.
So, yeah, I'm going to give a very brief synopsis for the people who haven't watched this episode recently. But you should just honestly, to our listeners, even if you don't watch Felicity, whatever, just watch this episode in a vacuum. It's just a great episode of television. Former Twilight Zone director Lamont Johnson helms this tribute to the sci-fi series in which a lovelorn Felicity visits a mysterious clinic that promises to heal her broken heart. However, no one will tell her what the cure actually entails. Despite repeated requests, so she bolts before her examination is done, only to learn later that the treatment has already begun. I'm going to read just a couple little reviews here of the episode. This was, as you can imagine, too, it's kind of chum in the waters for critics, too, right? Which is you're setting yourself up to be compared to arguably what some would agree, I imagine you too, as one of the greatest television shows of all time.
Yeah.
So you are a WB, you know, show about a girl in college who, and now all of a sudden you're putting yourself in a, you know, perhaps not the best comparison. That being said, Vulture said, this remarkable Twilight Zone episode billed as a major television event was a pleasure to watch, full of oddly quaint diction and Twilight Zone style edits. This is Abrams flexing his nerd muscle before we knew he had a nerd muscle to flex. Sci-Fi Wire said, one thing that can be said about the 22 episode season is it allows writers to be inventive, to think outside the box, or in this case, reveal what is inside it. The box is a metaphor for your late teens, early 20s. As Sally explains in her closing narration, it is a strange gray area where you want what you want, what you need, where you don't know what you want, what you need, and what you'll be. You're forever in question. And then the New York Times said, as a general rule, Felicity established its aesthetic in the pilot and didn't much deviate, which is part of why this wild gimmick episode from season two is such an enjoyable jolt. But it's not just the look, complemented by noirish lighting and period costumes, that is stylized. The actors also try on a kind of crisply articulated, slightly arched line readings typical of Twilight Zone era shows, with Amanda Foreman and Tanji Miller being the standouts. Janine Garofalo does a fantastic Rod Sterling imitation in the opening and closing voiceovers. And then in a letter accompanying a review copy of Felicity, so I guess they sent video cassettes to, I'm assuming, critics.
Yeah.
Abrams wrote a letter to each of the critics, and in it said, I'm sitting here writing this to you with an autographed photo of Rod Serling hanging on the wall behind me. I feel now, as I have in the past, that he's watching, saying to me, as he used to say to the writers who worked for him, write your dreams. Pretty lovely.
What a flex. JJ just jumping in, making this episode. He's like, I'm a fan, and I have this photo, and I'm doing it.
it's crazy. I mean, it really is. I mean, not to belabor the point, but it needs to be said that they have not made 30, maybe a little over 30 episodes of this television show.
Mm-hmm.
And the show's a hit in whatever that might be for a WB show back then. But like, this is just a long way of saying that it's a real flex. Like, it's a real swing to do something like this at this stage with this show in the place that it was in, it's pretty crazy.
No, absolutely. Because I think Buffy the musical was, I should be a super fan and know this, 6 or 7. I don't know. It was near the end.
Now I need to look it up.
5. Still very, very far into the show. And maybe that's just why in my head
it was in the 60s and you were right.
Okay, 6. Yeah, which makes sense. It's almost like when shows are kind of like dying down or moving into that final phase, like they'll just throw stuff like this in. And I don't know. It also speaks to, I'm curious, that Vulture review, was that more recent? Because
Vulture, these were all, to be honest with you, all three of these reviews were within the last couple years.
Okay. Because it watching now through the lens of knowing who JJ is, it's, mm-hmm. It's not prophetic, but it's like,
you're seeing someone who, understands what he wants to do. I just recorded an episode that will come out either next week or the week after with Joanna Robinson, where we talked about the final 5 episodes and talked about J.J. Abrams from sort of 30,000 feet and, you know, how his intent is clear. Now, whether or not he's always able to stick the landing is a debate that we can all have. And, you know, it is what it is. But he understands how to start something. He understands what the intent of a thing is. And that's why I think, like, as an episodic, I'm going to say genius, he's so good at giving you this incredible thing as it's happening in front of you. He wants you to have the most amazing ride in that moment. Now, he's not great at knowing tomorrow, but he's great at knowing now.
Yeah.
Right. And he can give you this amazing thing. And this is such a clear sort of mission of intent of like, I want to do this thing with these two things that I love and bring them together. And mashups don't always work.
No.
More times than not, they don't. So
this, you couldn't think of two more polar opposite things than Felicity and Twilight Zone, especially Felicity in season 2. Yes. And I just, he brought his fandom and his expertise of the world he'd created within Felicity and his, you know, wealth of knowledge of Twilight Zone and his wealth of knowledge of writing and filmmaking and knowing what it would mean to bring the original director in. And it was just this perfect marriage of, you know, something that meant something to fans. And I think it's even now I'm thinking, because I think last time we talked about JJ and what would it be like for JJ to have a show or be in series television still. And when I think of what he did with this and trusting his gut that long ago and knowing that this would work, I think of like The Leftovers or Watchmen and like, absolutely. God, if JJ was in television making something like that and bringing what he brought to this, to that, he should really get on that. We should let him know.
We should let him know. He's got something.
Really,
he's not focused enough. I'll say this, you know, as you were talking there, I was thinking about how this episode in its own way sort of reminds me of USS Callister. Oh, that's amazing. I'm just jealous.
It's the best.
Because it's, you know, unbelievable. And the cast on that thing now, like looking at like Michaela, it's just crazy. And obviously Kristen Milioti and Milioti. But it reminds me of that because this episode kind of feels like a Black Mirror episode. In its own way, it's and the Twilight Zone, obviously, Black Mirror owes a lot to Twilight Zone. That goes without saying. But it's just interesting to see, to your point, taking these two polar opposites and finding the similarities that exist in them. I mean, that also takes a genius too, to be able to say like, these two things can work together through this, you know, if we do it through this, this, and this, and we make it about love and we make it about, you know, it's really fascinating to watch as a TV writer to think about how JJ, and perhaps he was looking at it in terms of the placement of the season and thinking like, where does this slot in that makes the most sense, as you outlined earlier, that we're at an inflection point in the season and perhaps this is the best time to do this, because she soon gets into a relationship with that other guy that I don't really remember from season 2. Greg,
was he Ben?
I think was his name?
Is it Ben? No, then I'm not interested.
I need to have a conversation with you, another conversation with you about Ben, since I just rewatched the final episodes. So I need to talk about that for a second. But we'll talk about that in a sec. But this is a really special thing. And I love that thematically this episode is about Felicity not wanting to be hung up on Ben and Noel anymore, which I can only assume a lot of people might have been feeling at that time for the show, which is get over it, move on. And I think that that's pretty fantastic. It's an acknowledgement of itself.
Yeah. And I, going back and rewatching the Twilight Zone episode, there is a line in it where, you know, I think Tangi Miller is almost kind of playing her in this Felicity episode where there is a ballerina dancer. And she says, like, maybe we're just the loveless, like we just are the unloved. Mm-hmm. And I just, again, thinking like JJ could have done anything with any episode. There are so many episodes of Twilight Zone that he could pull from. But this one line that he's pulling from this one kind of random episode of the Twilight Zone and bringing it to life and really just tying the themes together. And seeing how much that ties into Felicity specifically. Like, yes, I agree that maybe people were kind of over the will they, won't they, or who will she be with thing. But also, it's sort of like Felicity is her feelings. Felicity is her emotions. And how terrifying would it be for her to just like rid herself of all of that? And yet that is what this episode is about. And so it's almost meta in that way where it's like, fine, you guys, you're tired of Felicity being so wishy-washy with her guys. Well, this is what it's like when she explores getting rid of that stuff and all of her feelings, which, you know, nobody wants a feelingless Felicity. Nobody.
I couldn't agree with you more. There are two lines to underline exactly what you're saying that I want to highlight. The first is she's in the doctor's office and she says, I put too much importance on things, romance and sex, I guess. For some horrible, annoying reason, love matters to me. Ben matters to me. Noel matters to me. And I'm sick of it. I'm sick of caring so much, feeling torn and wanting that connection, that soulmate. I just want this feeling to go away. And of course, that's exactly what this clinic wants her to say. And they want to hear from her. But then at the end of the episode, she says, not really hurting means not really feeling anything, then forget it. I'll take all of love's pain if it means I can feel some of love's happiness. It's just, it's good stuff. It's just great.
It's so good.
It's so good. And it understands, like, it just understands itself so well that it's hard to kind of, it's almost hard to articulate that the show is able to sort of funnel that through this, let's be honest, kitschy, fun, great, you know, experiment. Mm-hmm. And again, I just keep coming back to how it's just too smart for its own good at the time. Cause I'm just I remember watching the episode live and just being like, I mean, it's cool. It's in black and white. Like I get it, but like, I just didn't fully appreciate how special it was to do something like this.
And it's just really at its core, it's an exploration of how painful love is, especially when you're young and the extremes we want to go to rid ourselves of that pain. And that is everything that Felicity is about too. I just think, yes, it is a standalone episode and you could pop in and watch it or not. Mm-hmm. But I just think even with its ending, which is just so Twilight Zone and silly and not connected to anything else, It is. It's still completely on theme with the show and what the season continues to go on to do and the series for that matter, which again just adds to how smart it was. And it was way too smart for like all of this was lost on me back then watching it.
It was lost on me too. I think that, you know, it's the ending as campy and silly as it might be is perfect because in its own weird way, like I'm sure that, I mean, I know Amanda Foreman's been asked a million times, like what was in the box? What was in the box? And this obviously, and I hate to do this because it's so sort of, it's such well-worn terrain, but JJ Abrams in the mystery box, which is his, you know, he did obviously a TED talk about a mystery box, which he's never opened, which he got from his grandfather when he was young. And it is quite literally the most metaphorical JJ Abrams thing ever since everything he does is a mystery box. And that's fine. I don't begrudge him that. I do think that two quick things. The first is Joanna Robinson says something to me in the other episode, which is fantastic, which is that Damon Lindelof always believed and continues to believe that what needs to be in the box needs to be a person. That if what's in the quote unquote box is a person, it'll always have an emotional resonance. If what's in the box is a thing, it won't. If it's a doohickey or some sort of MacGuffin or some sort of a what have you, which let's be honest, JJ has done from time to time, it doesn't have the same resonance. Now, the irony in this is literally the people are in the box here. Mm-hmm. So there is a nice symmetry to that. But it's great that this happens so they never have to talk about the box again for all intents and purposes, right? Because it's like, who gives a shit what's in the box? Like, it's just have fun with the show.
Yeah.
So I'm okay with the ending being what it is. How did you feel about the ending?
I love it. And as someone that loves this episode of The Twilight Zone, this is the ending of the episode. And it is their dolls in the original Twilight Zone episode. It's also, again, tying it to that specific episode. They are dolls who are unloved in this moment, but they're in a drive to go to, like, in, you know, a homeless shelter or something like that. And
okay.
So even Rod Serling's, you know, voiceover is about, it's just momentarily they're unloved, but maybe they're on their way to love. And again, that's totally what this is too. Like, they're just feeling lost. And so for them to end this episode of Felicity in the exact same way and have Megan be kind of the puppet master, for lack of a better term, I think it was funny, and it was just a nice little kind of button on the box of it all. And
totally,
you know, they still did, like we've talked about, like kind of supernaturally things to an extent with Megan, and that's fine. But, you know, a season and a half in, I think we were good on the box, and this was like a fun thing to.
I agree. It also, to your point, to underline it, you know, that the purgatorial component of the box, first of all, made me think of Toy Story, but that's neither here nor there.
100% Toy Story.
So I'm wondering if Toy Story is a reference to this Twilight Zone episode, but the purgatory component of it is twofold. The first is it obviously speaks to college, right? Which is in the voiceover at the end that Janine Garofalo says, you know, Felicity Porter stuck in purgatory, you know, forever, essentially, or AKA college, something to that effect. So there's definitely the college component. But then there's the TV character component, which I love, which is that it's a commentary on the fact that to be a television character is to constantly be in some sense of a purgatory. You can never grow outside the box that the showrunner is essentially giving you. And that I love when they all are sort of working through, you know, when they're all stuck in the box in the last third of the episode, or the last act of the episode, all of them are talking about the various things that they hope to be, perhaps, maybe. And it's almost like the characters are talking to the writers in this weird way and saying, like, what is going to happen to me in the future? That's a whole other layer of metatextuality in terms of the fact that it's a show that knows it's a show, doing homage to another show that knows it's a show. Like, there's all these, it's like a nesting doll of references. It's pretty fantastic.
I love that. I didn't see it that way. I mean, now that you say it, I definitely do. And I think it's great. And it's also, I think something that people were always frustrated with Felicity with is she seemed unintentionally, I'll give her that, but she seemed very selfish and self-involved, and it kind of didn't matter who was with Ben or what Noel was doing. I mean, the episode before this about, like, well, I love you, Noel, even though you're with Ruby. And, you know, I think this also is everyone affected and in the box and in the, you know, the clinic piece of the episode. They're all just people who have been left in Felicity's wake because she follows her emotions and her life. And, you know, it's an exploration of her having to confront that as well and kind of recognize that, you can't just because they're your emotions and they're valid and they're your feelings, you can't just go with them all the time because other people and other lives are involved, and look at where it got you in this episode. And then also, you are just, at the end of the day, you're all stuck in the same spot and, you know, living your lives, but kind of in purgatory, and it doesn't really matter.
I think that there's, it's true what you're saying, and it kind of speaks to protagonists of shows, I think, generally have this problem, especially shows that are perhaps specifically named after one person, where the show feels like it's all in the shoulders of that character. They can seem selfish, right? I mean, it's always about that main character for some, unless mm-hmm. you have a two-hander, which can sometimes be a benefit. But yeah, I mean, it's hard for, and I appreciate when the supporting characters call out that character for these things, because at least it's an acknowledgement by the writers that, you know, this character is being shitty, but we don't really have a choice. So at least we're going to shine a light on the fact that this person's being shitty. So I do appreciate that when that happens from time to time. One of my favorites is, I know you didn't watch Sex and the City, but there's an episode where Carrie goes over to Miranda's with bagels. And Miranda's like, these are bullshit bagels. You brought these over to talk about your own shit. They're not to talk about my problems. They're talking about your problems, which I think is a great thing. But I also just want to say, you know, the New York Times article highlighted Amanda Foreman and Tanji Miller, and they're both fantastic in this episode. But, you know, Keri Russell in this episode is doing something truly fantastic. I mean, we all know she's a tremendous actress, but the modulation that she's doing between sort of that perfectly overdramatic Twilight Zone-y kind of mm-hmm. acting and also grounded, believable is really, really special, because you have to care about her in this episode. Otherwise it's just an affectation.
Yeah. It's the perfect balance with her specifically of very subtle moments, like just her eye work and her face work when the mm-hmm. woman first approaches her with the clinic yeah. card, and just like the weird putting the card away, and then, you know, you see her registering everything, and it's literally just wordless face work.
Perfect. Yeah.
And then beyond over the top Twilight Zone. I think I read the producer, he said like it was very difficult for him because Twilight Zone, directing it back then, like the acting was theatrical and, uh-huh. you know, it felt more like a play or a performance in that way. And that is what Felicity is doing and Keri Russell's doing in the moment where she's between the doctor and the nurse and like pointing really big and over the top. but both work in equal measure. And I will say for performances, mm-hmm. that really surprises me that they say that. Who did they say beyond?
It was Tanji Miller, who I thought was fine. But Amanda Foreman, she was barely in the episode. Yeah. No, I know. She was Elena.
No, Scott Foley. It's literally his audition tape for Scream. He is fully playing Roman. He is like aggressive and angry and mean and something you never see in Noel. And I thought that was great, too. He played this sort of like Stepford wife type man. And then, you know, this enraged Scream killer, if you will, which if spoiler you will. Alert I mean, for if everybody, you wanted to go apologize. There.
Yeah, yeah. I it's funny because I another thing that I think that Carrie does in this episode, and perhaps the other characters do it as well, but I noticed it prominently with her, was her understanding the lighting as well. You know, a lot of actors obviously understand lighting. They know, you know, how they want to look and they understand their image very well. But she uses, you know, the lighting in this is very stark, as you can imagine. It's, you know, it's a lot of gothic lighting, a lot of sort of crazy shadows and crazy lighting across eyes. And she just understands how to really run with that and weaponize that. So, you know, to she understands how much that says. So you can actually act less when you have this very dramatic lighting on you, which I think is a real testament, obviously, to her abilities. So to people who want to watch the Twilight Zone episode that this is based on, the episode was called Five Characters in Search of an Exit. And it came out in 1961. So apparently this director also had a very specific dolly that he wanted to use from the 60s. So the camera would physically move like it moved back in the 60s. So again, slowing things down, very deliberately done. But again, it's one of those things where I didn't notice it necessarily, but I'm sure subconsciously it's there. These are all things.
They are identical. I am telling you, the filmmaking, it's true to hear that. I'm like, of course you wanted that. And of course you made it work. And those scenes in that box on both episodes are truly identical, and they, you know, they elicit the same response from the viewer, and they look the same and they feel the same. I mean, the climbing, obviously I love that scene, just the way that they're all like straining, but it's the same in the original episode. Yeah, just everything. It truly, I was going to ask you just as a filmmaker kind of, and someone who doesn't have, you know, extensive experience watching Twilight Zone, like what is your response to it in that way? Just like visually, and do you see the, how, you know, just spot on it is in terms of that grayscale and the, you know, the Dutch tilted camera and, you know, all that?
Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, it's one of those things where, you're watching it and as someone who A, loves television and loves filmmaking, if you don't watch this episode and have a smile on your face, you're just too jaded and you can't enjoy anything anymore. Like, I think that it's such a love letter and such a lovely acknowledgement of the past while also being steeped in its present. But in terms of the filmmaking itself, you know, you mentioned them climbing on each other. I mean, they were obviously lying down, which is fantastic, right? Because you're like, there's no way that Carrie Russell's actually physically climbing over these people. So they're, the noises they're making and the what have yous to me are adorable, because I know that there's no strain whatsoever happening to them in this situation. But it's stuff like that, to your point, where if you know the quote unquote gimmicks, or you know the things that they did, the little tricks of how they made these things, and quite frankly still make these things, it adds a whole other layer of you know, sweetness to it. Like, how can you not love how, you know, how loving it is? But I would also say too, you know, you talk about the grayscale, you talk about the way that it's shot. You know, it's interesting because, you know, black and white movies back in the day, the way to show color, quote unquote, or texture was costumes. It was lighting. It was ways of showing depth through, you know, grayscale. And they do a really beautiful job in this. The costumes are really beautiful. I thought that, you know, one of the things we've talked obviously at length about Carrie's hair, I think her hair looks so good in this. I love the headband that she has in her hair. Mm-hmm. Like, it works so perfectly for the period. There's, you know, obviously she's a beautiful woman, but there's a symmetry to her face and the roundness of it with every sort of this very symmetrical world that she's a part of. I mean, that's the thing too about the Twilight Zone, or about shows back in the 50s and 60s, which is they're very sparsely designed. You know, you had very little art direction or production design really in a lot of these shows. It was all very sparse, which now seems strange. I mean, we expect all rooms to look and feel lived in, whereas back then they didn't care about such things. Yeah. So it's also interesting to sort of see that design element that they're playing into it as well. But yeah, I was really just sort of, I don't know. I loved it. I loved everything about it. Speaking of Buffy, just to rewind real quick, there's a quote here. Asked if this episode's otherworldly feel came out of Buffy envy, Abrams replied, "I am enormously envious of shows like Buffy the Vampire Slayer with its life or death issues. No one's necessarily going to try to kill you on Felicity." Still, he wasn't solely out to summon goosebumps. Serling created the Twilight Zone so you could tell stories as analogies. There is something underneath the story about this girl's search for love and her frustration in doing so. So again, like, an acknowledgement that Buffy can do things that he can't, and that he would then sort of try to do, I guess, with his future shows in terms of higher stakes. But it's really interesting to hear him talk about Buffy, because I don't know, like, those are two shows that are existing at the same time. I mean, Alias is on while Buffy is on as well, right? Buffy ends in, when does Buffy end? It's like
Buffy ended in 2004.
Right. Okay. So Alias has been on for 3 or 4 years at that point. Mm-hmm. Lost premieres in 2005. But it's interesting to sort of see these two kind of titans of industry that would go on to have these amazing careers, and just the acknowledgement of each other in it, I think, is really interesting. Yeah.
No, I like that quote a lot. And I, you know, for those of us that were part of the moment and watching both of these at once, or even Alias for that matter, they're kind of like distinct to you, but to hear them acknowledge the other. And also, there just was, we've talked about this, but there's not as much content back then. And so it was easy to be very aware of like the thing, the it thing, and what is Buffy doing when you're Felicity on the same network. Yeah, I think it was great. And I just going back to, I feel like I'm adding nothing insightful because I'm just so,
that's completely inaccurate. You are absolutely being insightful.
But we have to talk about Carrie's face because you brought it up.
Please.
She's always flawless. She's clearly, you know, a stunning human being and beautiful, but she is very symmetrical. And she, in this lighting, it makes her almost porcelain looking, which adds another layer because they're dolls in the end. Mm-hmm. And I just, she does, she gets it. She's the whole face of it. I mean, even if she was hideous for some reason, like she just gets what she is doing in this. And, yeah, it's great. You know, we could also do a whole episode on Julie and this episode, which
I would like to talk about Julie in this episode as well. If you all could see Meg's face
at the mere mention of Julie.
Yeah, she is kind of doing Julie. I mean, it's one of those things too, where when you realize that Julie has, and I do want to walk through the plot, but when you realize that she's been to the clinic, I'm like, yeah, of course fucking Julie's been to the clinic.
Yeah. Of course, on brand.
Very on brand. Very quick to throw her friend into the fire, but it's interesting nonetheless. But to walk through the plot really quickly, Felicity is working at, it seems like it's still Dina DeLuca because they don't take the sign off the window. But this woman comes in who sees her grappling with the love triangle that is this show in a lot of ways, and comes up to her, sees that she's struggling with love, and gives her a business card for the clinic. And so Felicity is sort of, she's truculent, she doesn't really want to do it or reluctant to do it, and then she says fuck it and she makes the phone call, and that's when we hear Janine Garofalo's first voiceover as Rod Serling, where she says, you know, Felicity Porter, blah, 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 making a phone call that will change her life forever, something to that effect. She goes to the clinic. She says that line, which we both love, about how she wants to get rid of these feelings and she's tired of having these feelings. The doctor comes in and gives her something to drink, which we never really find out what that is, but who cares? But she freaks out when he brings out one of those really ancient 1960s syringes that are so gigantic that you think that they're like for injecting horses or something like that. Like, it's just crazy. And she runs away. And she meets Elaine in the library, who tells her, she tells her about the clinic. And this is the thing, and you know the original episode better than I do, but what I love is that they found a way to get a Felicity Elena library scene in this episode.
Yeah.
You know, it's a bit of a trope of the show, which is that, you know, they're always at libraries, they're always having conversations at libraries, but that they get to find a way to do that and inform in this episode is also very brilliant. She sees a sickly man in the stacks who tells her to not go to the clinic. She says she rejected them and he says they're doing it to you already, which is like, I know enough about the Twilight Zone that like the act outs are so perfectly Twilight Zone act outs.
Yeah. Everything. And the casting too. That man, the woman who originally gives her the card, that woman could have been pulled out of an original episode. I mean, again,
so
too
good.
The styling, the makeup, the acting, the face, her just physical, it's eerie.
That woman doesn't blink. I'm pretty sure she doesn't blink. She's just got she's got such an eerie vibe to her. Mm-hmm. So then the woman comes back to the cafe the next day. And basically is like, you gotta go back to the clinic. And Felicity's like, I don't want to. She calls the clinic, says, stop harassing me. Now, this is one of my favorite parts, which is that night, Felicity's laying in her dorm room and the dictaphone starts to whisper to her, open 67.
Yeah.
Which is like, again, so JJ to have like a number and a thing that needs to be opened. Yeah. And that it's the dictaphone, which is so emblematic of this show. I love it.
It's also just creepy. It's like the voice is really creepy. I just love that they brought so much, you know, Twilight Zone could be not horror all the time, but it is. It's like got a scary movie element to it.
Yeah.
And it's unsettling. But yeah, to have this thing that's almost like Felicity's security blanket be this thing that actually is almost like a bad omen, or it's like there is no tape in it and it's still talking and it's, you know, it... again, all the little things that they brought in that still tied back to the original series. I think it worked really well.
Yeah, it's just, it's, I mean, and again, I don't mean to belabor the point, but the ability to be able to find ways to take the original episode of the show and find ways to have it speak to Felicity today and not in jarring ways. Like, this is all very organic, which mm-hmm. speaks to this shouldn't work. Like, this just should not work. And yeah.
Well, what they did, you know, I wish I could sit and talk to JJ about this specific thing, because I just have, even in the stuff I've read, I have a question about the way they did the episode, because mm-hmm. the first half, the clinic stuff, is just fully original material and just like this brilliant story that is very on brand with Felicity, but feels mm-hmm. Twilight Zone-y. And then it's when they wake up in the box and it's almost like pulled from the original episode, and the, you know, the cinematography is the same and some of the lines are the same, and why, you know, they chose to marry those two things, why they just, I mean, they, it's not in half, but they like divide the episode in like two thirds like, and a third. And it's, and one is almost, you know, it is the Twilight Zone episode.
Yeah.
But yet they still work so well together and, all feel very on brand for, both shows, actually.
It's, you know, as we get through the plot, there's a clear seam point. There's like a moment when they're essentially done with it, you know, with the first two thirds, and then they pivot to them being in the box, mm-hmm. Which when it first happened, it was a little jarring to me. And then I was like, well, no, I mean, ultimately it works because they're speaking to each other. Both these stories are speaking to each other, and whether or not we get a quote unquote resolution to the clinic storyline versus the box storyline is moot. I mean, ultimately it doesn't really matter. I mean, at this point, Julie finds Felicity in the library, tells her she needs to go back to the clinic. Julie tells her she had the procedure. Felicity asks what the treatment is. Julie's like, well, I can't tell you that. And then Felicity gets a weird, like, night cleaning job at some sort of a laboratory or morgue, which
weird,
whatever. It's
so
weird. So weird, but like, I understand the necessity of it, but it is one of those things where all of a sudden she's just like, I got a new job and I'm a janitor in a morgue.
Just like her overnight little janitorial duties, sweeping.
Yeah, whatever. Yeah.
Yeah.
I feel like on some level they were just like, she obviously needs to go to a morgue. She needs to open, you know, the number 67. They could have probably found a less weird way to do it, but it is what it is. So she sees that and this is one of those morgues, and I'm assuming back in the 60s, this is what they were like, which is that they on top of having drawers in morgues where you would pull somebody out of a fridge, you also had these sort of bins, these like metal mm-hmm. bins. And one of them has the number 67 on it. The way that the bin opens is so phenomenal. Amazing. I can't really, it just opens in a way that I can't really articulate, but it's eerie and it's slow, and she has to pull this weird lever in order to open it. And then the body starts to talk to her.
That's so good.
It's so good because his mouth doesn't move. It's like back in the day, for whatever reason, I'm going to assume it was production oriented. When dead bodies spoke or whatever, like, heads would just move and look at you, but mm-hmm. you'd hear them talking to you. And it makes it so much better. I can't explain why, but it's the best.
And it's very Twilight Zone. Yeah. That moment feels, again, the whole scene is like, what is happening? And why is this weird stuff happening? And why is she there? But it feels truly, just from the second she like looks, she's sweeping and looks up and sees the 67 in the cut in her eyes, and it is so Twilight Zone.
It's so good. He reveals that he has a scar over his chest, where his heart has been. He basically tells her that this is how they cure a broken heart. They tear your heart right out of your chest.
Yeah.
Which is the best. And she obviously runs to the clinic to confront the doctor about what's going on. And of course the doctor and the nurse are like both coming at her from either side of the hallway. She distracts them by throwing the glass heart that she received the business card in at the wall. They all seem like surprised and legitimately kind of shocked by how it breaks. Like, there's a part of me that's like, they only had like two hearts, so they like threw one and everyone was like, oh, that's how it breaks, okay. So, which is kind of great. Then she goes to Noel for comfort. She fears she's going crazy and hallucinating all of this. And then there's a really great part here, which I want to get your thoughts on, where Noel says to her that everyone has their addictions. He tells her that love is her vice and then tells her that she's his vice. There's something really, I mean, again, this speaks to how this episode really does have echoes of what's going on in the show, Felicity. Mm-hmm. Because something like this, and this is why I think this episode is actually important, which is that it can say things about the show that the show can't do in its own episodes.
Mm-hmm.
So you can have something like this where you can be so bald about your themes and about what you're trying to say because it's the 60s and subtext was not as prevalent. But I love it so much. And it does speak to, for me anyway, their relationship moving forward. How did you feel about it?
No, I felt the same way. In the importance of it within, you know, the Felicity, everyone says it's not canon. And I actually do feel like it is because
I agree.
Again, it's really the first time we see Felicity being really reflective on mm-hmm. her love life and mm-hmm. the actions she takes with these men and her friends and how it impacts her, you know, world outside of just her little bubble. And then it's Noel saying that to her, which is never something he would say in real life, just sitting there. But it speaks to where the show does go. I do think, you know, on the flip side of that, it's very strange that Ben is so kind of light in the episode because the prior yes. episode is him really going hard on trying to get back with her or realizing he has feelings yeah. with her.
Yeah.
And you know, the cliffhanger, but it's interesting. They did it with Noel. It was a great reveal because yeah, I think we all know that like of the two, Noel is the one that's always just kind of there and will be there for her, the sweet puppy dog mm-hmm. guy. But to hear him say it so explicitly is really fascinating. And it just continues. I mean, it is. It's just so representative of the relationships in the show. I mean, Elena has moments with Felicity like that too. Mm-hmm. Elena's just pulled out of a regular episode and plopped into this. I just, I don't.
100%.
Yeah.
Yeah. I fully agree with that. I think that, you know, the show being able to, this episode being able to underline Felicity's perhaps unhealthy obsession with love, to quote Moulin Rouge weirdly. But I think that...
my other favorite movie. You're just bringing up all the faves today.
No, Moulin Rouge is the best. I love it. But yeah, when he says to her, thank you for curing me of my unhealthy obsession with love. But she does have this sort of... And perhaps it's a little bit indicative of her age and the place that she's in, you know, existentially and what have you. But I do think that him being able to say that to her... and for her to come back at him and say the line that I read earlier about how if, you know, not really hurting means not really feeling anything. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think we all kind of agree with Felicity on some level, right? Which is, I mean, I'm sure some of us have been burned harder than others by love and perhaps, you know, there's that. But it's really fantastic that the show found a way to really crystallize these ideas, and the way that they did that was through this experiment and through this, you know, through this episode. It's really pretty phenomenal.
Yeah. I feel like
it turns on itself
something.
At this point because Felicity then sees that Noel has the glass heart on his table.
Oh no, I'm sorry. I was just going to say, I feel like you would miss something. I know it's a standalone episode, but for moments like that, I do feel like you're missing some of the essence of the show and where the relationships go if you don't watch and see that moment with Noel and Felicity, where you don't hear Felicity kind of process and go through the entire, you know, the full gamut of, I don't want to, I'm brokenhearted. I need to be healed. I can't feel any of this anymore. Oh, wait, what does it mean when I don't feel it? Oh no, I want to feel everything regardless of how much it hurts. Like that's Felicity in a nutshell. And that's Noel in a nutshell. And I think if you don't watch that, yeah, there's a million other times you're going to get to see these relationships continue to play out. But, it is essential within the arc of the show, I would say, for that reason.
I absolutely wholeheartedly agree with you. I think that it's, you know, Felicity isn't a show that has fans in the way that genre shows do, right? Like if you're a Buffy fan, or I mean, I guess there are Dawson's Creek fans as well, and shows of this nature that people were fans of, but you can see, as we talked about earlier, the JJ flex of it all in terms of the kind of nerd flex, but this show doesn't have the same sort of honestly, the same sort of fans, right? And if you're a real fan of this show and watch this episode, you will see the echoes. You will see the ripples of how it is not just a throwaway gimmick episode. It really does fold into the character arcs of the show. It does it a disservice to say, oh, wasn't this cute? They did a black and white Twilight Zone episode when there's so much going on in it. Felicity then sees Noel has the scar on his chest, and he flips out on her and tells her that the only way through their drama is for everyone to have their hearts taken out, basically. and then Noel tells Felicity to take a deep breath, and she doesn't really understand what he means by that. And he says, because that's how anesthesia works. And now she's on the operating table, and she's had her heart taken out. And that's basically sort of it. Now, you know, I love the take deep breaths anesthesia component of it. I'm not really sure how logistically it works, because I'm not really sure how we got from A to B, but it's cool.
Yeah. Yeah, they just kind of hop around there. There's these three moments where we're like, Nolan, Felicity, Felicity's yeah. heart's gone, box.
Mm-hmm. Yep. It's a great, I love the shot, the reveal of the scar on her. She's got, obviously she's covered up, so she's not revealing herself, but it's done in a mirror from this high angle that looks like sort of from it's in an operating room. Mm-hmm. It's a great moment. It's a great shock. Then she wakes up after the commercial break and she's in a box. There's no scar on her chest. She's like, oh, it must have been a dream. Which again, like, sure, fine, whatever. I mean, sure. I don't really, it's one of those things where, and I don't, you've watched more Twilight Zone than I have. And, you know, I haven't watched a lot of television from the 60s, but they play it pretty fast and loose, right? Mm-hmm. In the sense of audiences, like we've spoken, weren't as savvy back then as they are now. They didn't watch television with the discerning eye that they watch TV now with. So you could get away with flying through stuff and just breezing past things, which obviously they weaponize in this episode, which I'm completely fine with.
Yeah, Twilight Zone, there's very, I would say more often than not, there is no real explanation for why things are happening, or you're just bopping mm-hmm. around, like you're in a town and then all of a sudden you're somewhere else, and there's very little explanation for it. So it works within that context.
Absolutely. Yeah. Once we're in the box, there's a few things that I really love. I love that the characters just materialize out of the shadows. Mm-hmm. You know, each of the characters kind of just show up, which is fantastic. I love Noel saying, I've been in college for 3 years and basically have no friends, which, like, of his own, which I think is sort of true, right? Which is that, like, did he have any social circle before Felicity came into his life? Like, short of his brother showing up at one point, like, you really just have no sense of Noel having any life before Felicity.
No, just Jennifer Garner.
Just Hannah, who just Hannah. I need to get your thoughts on her coming back in the final five episodes. We'll talk about that in a second.
I just like, I need to rewatch. I don't have like the most memories of the end, other than, again, you know, Ben. Just Ben. Ben's the memory.
I love that Nalena says, none of us can remember anything before college, which again speaks to sort of the metaphor of these television characters existing in some sort of weird vacuum that have no real time or space prior to it. Julie saying, I wish I had my guitar, and Noel saying, thank God you don't have your guitar.
Sorry. It's just like, I don't want to be mean because Amy Jo Johnson was great. Like her music was great. She's a great actress, but like, I just feel like there are moments in this where they are just speaking for the audience, especially right mm-hmm. now. I think they're speaking for both people who can relate to that moment, mm-hmm. but also that to me is like, and Noel being so just like, cutthroat. Was just the funniest.
It's fantastic. This is the thing about that perhaps people who watch television or fans of television might not completely understand, which is why an episode like this is such a gift. It's such an opportunity to be able to free yourself of the shackles of quote unquote the reality of your show, and that you can comment on the things that exist in the show. It gives you a freedom to be able to say, like, we know what we're doing. Like, I know you love these characters, but it's a little silly that X, Y, and Z. And I think that that's such, I can't highlight that enough as to why, you know, why JJ would want to do it, why the writing staff would want to do it, why the directors and the cast, like, think about how much fun it must have been to make this episode, to be an actor wearing these costumes, to be free of all of the sort of preconceived notions of your character. I mean, thinking about what Carrie gets to do in this episode, to be able to sort of deconstruct Felicity like a doll and be able to sort of look at all the pieces of her like a butcher's block is really pretty amazing.
It is. And once they're in the box, the care with which all of those actors are handling the performances, it feels like you can, the respect they have for both JJ and Matt and then Twilight Zone itself, it's just kind of like just flowing out of the TV at you. Especially, again, I do encourage you to go and watch this original episode because
I will
of the Twilight Zone, because when you were talking about when they're clearly laying on the ground and climbing up and out and like the straining, they are doing that exact thing in the original episode, and coming out of the shadows, that is that moment. And I just think they're not trying to emulate the performances exactly, but the tribute they're paying to that and the
reverence,
clearly the importance that it held for them to do that justice was lovely.
Oh, there's, I mean, I don't doubt it. I feel like I didn't do my homework. I should have watched that episode. And I appreciate that you did, very much so. But I think that to your point, the whole thing is such, again, it's reverence, but it's also, look at what it's giving us. Like, it's giving us this ability to be able to, it's giving us a whole new lens to see this show through, which for everyone involved is truly the greatest gift you could ask for. It's really, really, really impressive. I think that, you know, we talked a little bit about the ending, but essentially they crawl over each other. Felicity is able to crawl out of the box. She falls down, or first she screams in horror at what she sees outside the box. And then she falls. And then we cut back to the box and everyone's like, what's there? What's there? What's their side? Blah, blah. And then Megan picks up one of the little dolls and says, you're going back in your box with all your friends. And then she closes the box and that's the end. And it's great. I also just love that it is the same box, right? Like, it's completely out of period and completely makes no sense for it to be there. But that's what's so perfect about it. Like, all the stickers all over it, all the like punk rock craziness that's all over that toolbox that Megan has, feels so anachronistic, and yet works so well.
I don't want to take it personally that you skipped over Ben's moment in the box.
No, I actually was about to. I wasn't going to. But wow.
So we've moved ahead. I want to talk about Ben and
No. I want to talk about it too. I really do. I was holding on to that to talk about, but God bless you for your love of Ben Covington.
It's just this moment that he gets in the box is truly like, again, it felt like a wink and a nod to the audience thinking Ben's just like dumb and simple is the way to put it.
Basically, what happens is they're all talking about their futures and Ben's like, but I don't have a future. And then Noel's like, yeah, you don't.
That's so
basically
good.
What it was. It's great. But it is definitely a, so this is my question, because we're going to talk about Ben's future for a second here.
Okay.
And I know you haven't seen seasons 3 and 4 in a while.
A little bit.
No, I really only have to remind you of a couple of things.
Okay.
Ben becomes a doctor, Meg.
What? Really?
Ben goes to medical school and becomes a doctor. Now,
and you wonder why I believed in Ben from the beginning. I've always knew he had it all in him. He did it.
Yeah. I mean, some would label that as delusional because Ben is never going to be a doctor. Ben is never going to get through med school. So it's one of those, and I say this not as to be derisive of his character, because I really do, and I'm going to explain to you why I think, as much as it annoys me, that she should end up with Ben at the end of the series. Whether or not she ends up with Ben forever, we can debate that. But I think that I really appreciate that they want to take Ben from being, you know, a dumb golden retriever and turn him into a person of substance. I appreciate that. And that he appreciates that about himself and wants to be a better person. All of that is great. That's good TV. Mm-hmm. They overshot by making him a doctor. There's a bunch of things that they could have done or careers that they could have done or even just been specific about it in the sense of him wanting to be a sports physician or something along those lines so that I see the connective tissue. But instead, it feels like, well, I want to hang out with Felicity more, so I guess I need to go to medical school. That's just not a good enough reason.
I will give you that. I didn't remember any of that. But yeah, but you know what? Ben just floated about college. He was mm-hmm. having affairs. He was swimming and making coffee and breaking hearts and, you know, putting like them back together. Right now. I just, you know, Ben could do it just, all. Ben could do it.
I'm just picturing you wistfully thinking about Ben making you coffee, and it's just, it's great. But I really do want to sort of get on Team Ben with you for a second here for the end of the series. And I know that you don't remember all the mechanics of it, but from 30,000 feet, essentially what happens is Felicity travels through time and is essentially put in a mental institution. Oh, and God. Ben is the only one who believes her. So
you guys can
I wish
see.
I wish I had a screen grab of that look on your face. It's it literally screamed, isn't Ben the best?
This is why we believe in Ben. This is why we believe in Ben. He comes through.
Yeah, sure. And again, I, you know, we had this discussion a little bit when you were on for the Love Bug. And my beef has always been that Felicity brings more to the table for Ben than Ben brings to the table for Felicity. I just think that Felicity is a more complex character, and I think that she, quite frankly, and this might sound crazy to say this, but like deserves someone of that weight. And they do their best to bring him to that place by the end of the series so that to some degree, when he says, I believe you, and is essentially the skeleton key that gets her out of this time travel situation that she's in, it does go a long way to at least making me believe that they should be together at the end of this series. Now, Ben has a lot of explaining to do, and I don't know if Ben and Felicity are together still, but I think that for an end of series, they found a way. They had to have them end up together, right? Like there wasn't a world where they didn't. So they did it in a way where, and again, I'm just telling you because I know you don't really remember, but like the show ended after 17 episodes. They wrote a season, and it ends with Felicity going back to Palo Alto to study medicine, mm-hmm. and Ben follows her there. So there's a symmetry.
Full circle. It's like I've never seen the show. I'm sorry. I did not remember any
No. And listen, I think most people have blocked out the end of Felicity. And I would say unjustly, because I do think that the show finds a way, to your point, to have him meet her. Like this idea that she followed him and now he's following her, I think is a really beautiful, nice way to end the show. That's how it ends at 17. Then they get 5 more episodes and they have to figure out a way to do 5 episodes of time travel or whatever that, you know. And I appreciate the swing and we're going to have Lawrence Trilling and Josh Reams are both going to come on to talk about these final episodes. And I'm very curious to talk to Josh Reams about sort of how you break this after breaking 17 episodes, which is crazy. Yeah. But I think they find a way to, in a very kind of Tammy and Eric Taylor way, find a way for him to come to her and say, you know, it's your turn. Like, you deserve this, and it's my turn to be at your side. That makes me like Ben. I mean, that makes me think that this guy understands the mistakes he's made, and why, you know, all of that. I also love at the end of season two when he brings her the canister and says it's a time machine. I mean, listen. Ben, I have not given Ben the credit that he deserves. I think I've always been so staunchly Team Noel that I haven't been able to fully recognize the fact that they do go out of their way to make Ben a better character by the end of the show and worthy of Felicity's affections. So
I think he is more thoughtful than he gets credit for. Like, the episode before this one, when they're back from Christmas break and he tells Sean, like, I think your advice was bad. I do want to be with Felicity. Yeah. And just the moment when they're back at Dean and DeLuca, and he's too slick for his own good, because he's literally just as I say, smile talking at her across the counter.
The entire series, he smiles through every line of dialogue.
Yes, I got you on board. I am so happy, because this has been a lifelong mission to get recognition for Ben's smile talking skills. But you see, I think you see two things in that moment alone. I know that was the episode prior, but Felicity's fighting it. She's just like, what's going on here? But she has those feelings for him. Ben is completely genuine in his feelings about wanting to get back with her. And, you know, he'll mess up and do things again. But it just took a lot. It just took a lot for them to get there. It took spanning time for them to finally get there. I do appreciate, now that you're saying that, I didn't remember about the Ben believing her thing, but I'm a huge, humongous horror fan. Horror movies are my favorite. They're getting me through quarantine. And
wow.
I'm
the exact opposite. I have enough anxiety in my life. It just makes me even more anxious, but I appreciate that that's,
you know, same. I don't know why it has the opposite effect. You know, I have the same feelings as you, but I love it. But my one thing in life, and I say it to my husband every time we watch a horror film, is if I tell you something's happening, you better believe me. You will not gaslight me. You will not say this. Like, and for Ben to be there, I'm doubling down on my Ben love now that you're telling me
that's
that he
so
believes
funny.
Her. It's very important.
Yeah, it's very important. I mean, it should be said that Noel doesn't necessarily not believe her. I mean, he certainly believes her less than Ben. Ben, and again, I don't mean to get into the weeds on this episode, but essentially what happens is she tells him that his dad is sick and that he's going to call him and tell him that he's sick. And then Ben gets a phone call saying that his dad is sick. And that's sort of the thing that makes him go, oh shit, she's telling the truth. The difference, of course, is that she doesn't give Noel that weapon. So Noel doesn't have that tool in his belt to be able to be like, oh, she is telling the truth.
A Noel defender over there. Well, look at you.
It's a little bit different. I mean, she does tell him some stuff from the future. It doesn't matter. Long story short, obviously Ben deserves it all works out in the end. But it is interesting, to your point, that, you know, that the most important thing is to be believed, that he believes in her, that he believes her and believes in her is something that is, I mean, that's what we all look for in a partner. It's what we look for in our friends. It's what we look for in the people that are most important to us. So I spent, over 2 hours talking with Joanna Robinson about these five episodes. And in some regards, we were kind. In some regards, maybe we weren't. but the more I think about it, the more I appreciate not just the swing, but how effective it was emotionally, and that they tried to still be true to the show, be true to the characters. Series finales are really fucking hard. And, you know, they're hard on a good day. But then when you actually do a good job and then they tell you to do five more of them, it's like, I don't know. I mean, I can't even imagine. Do you have, while we're on the subject briefly before we wrap up, but do you have favorite series finales?
I would have prepped for this question, because I definitely do. Mine are all just very you know, more sentimental, more comedy based. Like I think Parks and Rec was perfect I thought The Office was pretty perfect. In addition to horror films, Schitt's Creek has gotten me through for the first time ever has gotten me through quarantine. I can't believe we just found it, but that was perfect. I think they're a little bit easier to stick the landing on. Obviously there's not the emotional stakes. Like the Buffy was not one for me. Sorry.
That's an amazing face.
Because it's hard when you're like, that is the thing that I was part of that fandom. And that was disappointing. I think Dawson's Creek was amazing. You know, issues here and there, but like, I was definitely into the ultimate way that it ended. And I love the Lost finale. I am of
Look
the,
at you. That's yeah. you and Joanna Robinson. You know, I started, this is one of those things where, and I don't know if you're dealing with this in the pandemic, but I certainly am, where it feels like you have endless amounts of time, obviously, right? You're just like, oh, well, I have all this time, so why don't I do a rewatch of a thing that I love or whatever the case might be? But there's also so much new shit or so many things that I haven't seen that are either from the last couple of years, whatever, that I'm sort of struggling with. Do I want to do a Lost rewatch knowing that the time commitment that goes into that?
Yeah.
I really would love to. I was not a hater on the finale in the way that a lot of people were. Just to pause it on series finales for a quick second, I do think that we live in such a different world now where creators are able to pull the plug on their own shows and or know that a show is only going to be X amount of episodes. You know, the streaming world, the cable world have really given those writers those opportunities. And Mike Schur to a degree on The Good Place, where he was like, it's four seasons and we're done.
Great series finale. Sorry. Amazing. Finale.
Yeah. 100%. But this is a kind of a long-winded way of saying that part of the problem, I think, with a show like Buffy, or even a show like Lost, even though Lost got to end on its own terms at a certain, you know, at a certain point, they're like, this is it, this is what we're doing. It's so hard in the broadcast model that used to exist, where it's like, can you please make 500 episodes of this thing that people love? And then when you could not care less about it at this point, can you please make us something really emotionally resonant and satisfying?
Yeah.
You know, it's very, very hard. Ending a broadcast show, I would argue, is exceedingly more difficult than ending a cable show, or a streaming show.
I think, you know, I think you just, there's like a suspension of disbelief with this, a little bit with Dawson's, if I'm remembering correctly. I was not, I told you last time, like I wasn't allowed to watch Dawson's, so I was kind of in and out on it.
Racy for you.
Really crazy racy.
So racy.
Just a real, you know, I question anyone who watched it because of moral issues.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
But Lost and The Leftovers, I'm not just a Damon person, I promise, but I think they're the same thing. I don't need all the answers, and I don't need everything to just wrap up in a bow, as long as it's 6 feet under, perfect finale of all time.
My favorite show ever,
is it? I've been wanting to do a rewatch of that.
You should rewatch that. It's the best.
But I think maybe that's why I'm more forgiving too of Felicity of it all, because, you know, they had an opportunity, they were told to make more, they made more, and they did something with it, just like they did with this Twilight Zone episode. And, you know, ultimately, sorry to bring it back to it, but Felicity and Ben ended up together. So we've mission accomplished.
I want to say one last thing very quickly about finales, which I talked with Joanna a little bit about, and I'm curious to hear your thoughts on it as well, is I think that there's an unfortunate misnomer that comes with genre shows versus non-genre shows. And I think it's that the mythology matters. And I think that's a fandom problem. Mm-hmm. That's when people forget what's important. What's important are the characters. What's not important is the smoke and mirrors and jazz hands that are going on in the background with your numbers or your dragons or your whatevers. It just doesn't ultimately matter. And if the showrunners put too much importance on mythology when they try to end their shows, I think they make the the mistake of not putting it all in on character, which is, I think, the major misconception about the end of Lost, which is that, yes, they had arguably one of their worst episodes. The Allison Janney episode is not good, but it was an episode to basically be like, here's a fucking bucket where you can put all your mythological bullshit if you want. And then we're going to spend the rest of this series trying to deal with the characters and making you care about the characters. And, you know, it's the mistake that Game of Thrones makes, which is a whole bunch of them, but ultimately becoming a show about spectacle rather than a show about its characters, which is what people ultimately really loved. So I guess my question to you is, you know, Buffy, which is a show that I didn't see every episode of Buffy. Did you feel like they didn't, like, was it a mythological issue? Was it a character issue?
I wouldn't say it was character. So maybe it was more mythology based. I think sometimes, though, your feelings on the series finale are very tied to your feelings on the final season as a whole. And for me, I appreciated elements of things that Buffy did. It just became a very different series. And some of the you know, you don't know the show, but like everyone becoming a Slayer and all the young up and coming Slayers, like I didn't like a lot of those actresses, the characters that they were playing. And so it just like, it would take you out of it in the end. But I do agree, the Lost and Leftovers specifically to me, you know, I think you could go back and watch all of Lost and all of the Leftovers again. And there are not answers to every single thing. They never tied up everything with a bow prior to getting to the finale. And for me, it's the journey and the characters and the emotional resonance. And
I totally
Leftovers clearly had that. And, you know, the final shot of Lost is beautiful. And, you know. I loved it.
As I said to Joanna Robinson in the episode we had together, I think that the best television shows are about taking a group of people, breaking them into a million pieces, and then spending the duration of your series putting them back together again, so that at the end of the show, these people that you've grown to love can go off and have, you know, a great life or whatever the case might be. And I think that we don't give enough credence to how fundamentally important it is that a series finale leaves you in a place like. It's so unfortunate that we live in a world now where, you know, Twitter, film Twitter, all these, whatever you want to call it, where so much importance is put on crazy things happening, where it just like it's a little bit of the Ryan Murphy thing. It's a little bit of the like, what's the noisiest, stickiest, or whatever fucking word you want to associate with it that'll trend on Twitter so that people are talking about your show. And that's not good. That's not good for TV. So I'm glad to see people like Damon Lindelof and Mike Schur and whoever it is that really are just focused on telling the best stories they can and making sure that the characters, you know, leave us in the best way possible. So,
yeah, anyway. You're making me think of Justified too, which I feel was a
perfect example.
Like total character driven, and what a nice little wrap up for all those people.
For sure. I mean, The Americans is another example where, you know, that was a show that I think a lot of people were expecting a very sort of flashy, crazy ending. And that show ends in a very somber, very sort of existential, as it should. I mean, it was akin to the show that came before it. Same with Mad Men, same with these shows that understand what they are, and they're going to end on their own terms, and they're going to end that's best for the show, not what's best for the viewers. So,
sorry, I can't let you wrap up without saying Breaking Bad. I'm ashamed. Like, my all-time favorite show.
It's great. No, Breaking Bad's phenomenal. I mean, Vince Gilligan is, I mean, a genius. His shows from people that I know that have worked in them or what have you. I mean, it's a Swiss watch, and he's working on another level. I mean, these are, we're very lucky that we live in a time where we have writers that are being given the power and the privilege to be able to end shows in the way that they want to end them. And for the most part, save of, I don't know, say Game of Thrones, most of these shows are ending in a way that is, you know, with reverence to what came before it, rather than trying to do something crazy and bombastic.
Yeah. So
that's sort of where I am. But anyway, I so appreciate you coming back to talk about this episode, Meg. I really, I had
Thank
a blast.
Thank you. So fun.
And I hope that you'll come back for more TV or anything like that in the future.
Look, I'm always available for anything. Ben, Buffy,
sure,
Breaking Bad.
Yeah, sure. Well, Breaking Bad wasn't on in 99, but we're definitely going to do Buffy. So you're
going to tie things back. There's time travel. We could figure it out.
Yeah. It's, you know, it's so funny. Buffy is, it's like the show. I feel like if you, of most of our guests, that's the show that most people want to talk about. People love Buffy.
It's a great one. There's a lot to mine there, I would say.
Oh, 100%. And I look forward to exploring it. Obviously, when we do, however we do it, we'll figure out some way to do it. But it's awesome. Just a little unwieldy because it's this beast of the show. But we'll figure it out. But
thanks
you
for having me.
Of course,
so
of course.
Fun.
Hey.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Guys, it's me again. So now we have my interview with Robert Benedict, who plays Richard on Felicity. We talk about his relationship with Scott Foley and the cast, specifically how he got the role, what it was like playing Richard, playing off of Scott Foley as Noel, and sort of the ups and downs that happened with that show. It's a really fun interview. He's a really great guy. So stick around for that. Thanks. Welcome to Podcast Like It's 1999. I'm your host, Phil Liskov. And with us today is Robert Benedict, who played Richard on Felicity. Currently, he's on Supernatural playing Chuck/God. I don't watch Supernatural, so I can't speak to that, but I'll take you at your word.
That's right.
So I want to sort of take us back to 99. And I guess for you, it's December of 98 that your first episode of Felicity airs, which is Finally, which was the one about the winter finals. And it was the last episode that aired in 98. So it was sort of the winter finale.
Yeah.
So where were you? Yeah, I guess I'm assuming you're living in LA at the time, but like, how did the show come into your life?
So I was watching the show with my wife at the time, and we really liked it. We had, you know, we just come off watching like 90210 and Melrose Place, and we loved those shows. So Felicity really caught our eye. So we were watching, and I was fans of the show. So when I got the audition, I got an audition, you know, early on, because this is, what was that, episode 9, I think?
Yeah, episode 9, like yeah.
And so I got an audition. I was like super excited. Oh my God, it's Felicity, that show we were watching. And so I go in and I do it. And then I got a call back that same day. I go back in and I meet with JJ, who at the time, you know, JJ Abrams I didn't know who that was. Like,
sure. He wasn't JJ Abrams yet.
Exactly. So, but he is an amazing guy and just, you know, he deserves everything he's gotten because he, you know, he had that even early on. Right.
Sure.
So I go in the room with him and he gives me another scene to do. And it's this scene with me and Felicity and Noel when I catch them making out in the, mm-hmm. in the book stacks in the library. And, I say, I'm going to report your ass. And it was the line. And like, I think he was smart to be like, I'm going to report your ass. I think it was like that. And I was like, and just for some reason in my mind, it was like, I'm going to report your ass. And it was like, because I almost like said it all like differently than he had imagined it. I think he was like,
sure.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. So that kind of became my, you know, I think that was maybe what got me the role. And then we were off and it was awesome. I remember that very clearly just because it was my first episode and we shot it at USC and it was middle of the night. We were working all night long and, I remember I'm in a band and we had to cancel a gig that we had that night. So I went in and did that scene. And I remember Carrie was really funny about it too. She's like, oh my God, J- JJ, are you hearing how he's doing this line? Are you hearing this? And JJ's like, yeah, yeah, no, I know.
So you auditioned and then you were called back in the same day. So that's a pretty quick turnaround. I mean, I'm not an actor. I've done auditions for shows that I've been on, but
it was the olden days, right? I went in for I think it was just for casting and maybe the director, and then they call me back in. Yeah. Same day. It's one of those parts I think that they needed to cast quickly or something.
Quickly. Sure.
Yeah.
So did you feel like in that moment when you sort of delivered the line in the way that you delivered it, do you feel like you kind of locked into Richard in that moment? Like, did it feel like you were sort of like, I know who this guy is?
Yes. Yeah. There was not that I had planned it or that I sat there with it all night long. Obviously I just got the scene, but in that moment. And I think the thing that clicked with JJ about it, and again, it was one of those things when you get a role, it's just, you make a choice and you're seeing it the same way that they're excited about seeing it. And so in that moment I did, I always kind of came back to that. I'm going to report your, like, it was like, I'm going to report your ass. Like, he just is such a rule follower. Things were so important to him. Just follow the rules. Right. And especially when it came to Noel. You know what I mean?
Yeah, there's this very interesting, and obviously I want to hear your thoughts on this, but the dynamic between Noel and Richard is interesting because it turns into a brotherly sort of situation, very much so. But in the beginning, it feels like he's an authority figure and you're looking up to him and he's disappointing you.
Yes. Yeah.
And then it becomes, you guys find level playing field to a certain degree where you understand, at least he starts to understand how ultimately psychotic you are and he's okay with it.
Exactly.
But I guess so coming into it in that sort of, I guess to rewind for a second, when did you know you were coming back? I mean, they brought you back pretty quickly and you were in a good stretch of episodes.
Yeah. Yeah. I can't remember when I knew. I just remember maybe a few weeks later getting a call like, hey, they want you back to do another episode, and going, oh, wow. And the next episode I was in, I was just more of a sort of a guy in the dorm. I don't know if I had a lot to do, but I think I had I might have had a moment with Mandy, Megan Mandy, you've had on.
Of course.
But then it was like, then they kind of had started a little like storyline for me to do. And so, yeah, I did a few more episodes that season. And yeah, one of the last ones, him and I were like living together, and I was upset because he got home late.
Yeah. And you had you had the cold cream on your face. Basically.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, it was, yeah. I mean, they really, really went for it. And I really think that I'm trying to think of the best way to, so this show really finds a balance in its humor.
I think
that it never sort of tips into being broad, or at least too broad.
Right.
I'd say you are the farthest flank. The character that goes kind of the farthest.
Right.
But I would also say that, you know, you don't feel like a caricature, even if it's dangerously close at times. It never fully tips.
Yeah.
And I think part of that's in your delivery and it's in your performance. And how do you find that balance? How do you keep him grounded and feeling like a real person?
I mean, for me at all, I mean, that's my wheelhouse. I love being the sort of comedic relief on a drama.
Sure.
You know, because I do understand, like, for me, it has to come from a real place, even though this is an outrageous person. He doesn't know he's being funny.
Yeah.
You know that. And he's the ultimate example of he's not a cut up. He's actually a very serious person. It's just funny. It's funny to not be him and look in on it. You're laughing at him. So he doesn't know it's funny. So I just went back to the trying to play the realism of being this just super intense person who's just like really, all of a sudden just attached himself to Noel. Like, that's, you're my good buddy, whether or not Noel wanted it or not, you know, that's what he wanted.
Sure.
And then they allowed me in season 2 and 3, they allowed me to do some very serious subjects, you know, like maybe Richard's gay. And then, I'm a virgin and lost my virginity. some of the other, my friends, cause we all keep in touch, the actors on that show. And a lot of them forget about those things that they had me do just because it's like, oh my God, right. I had sex with Tyra Banks. Like that was my first.
It's a hell of a first.
I mean, I know, right?
Listen, good for Richard.
Yeah, I know. And she's twice my size.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's something, and that sort of speaks to the show as well. And it is a little bit of an anomaly, I guess, in JJ's oeuvre, if you will. I mean, he did a couple other character shows, you know, your Six Degrees, your What About Brian's, but like this was the one that sort of that really clicked and really found an audience. And sort of that groundedness, that almost Cameron Crowe kind of vibe that he wanted, that earnestness, that believability.
Yeah.
And at the same time, finding the levity and the humor and the silliness that needs to exist and exist in everyday life. And you being that flavor in the show, there's a lot of responsibility that comes with that. And I guess sort of how did you handle that responsibility?
That's a great, I've never heard that before, the Cameron Crowe comparison, because it really is, you know, like you think about Saying Anything, you know, there are characters in that are kind of, that are crazy. Those are the characters you quote, you know, because it's hilarious, but then there's such grounded, serious topics in that movie. The writing was always so good on that show. Mm-hmm. I just went back to the writing. I didn't have to overthink it. You know, I just was having a great time with these people I loved working with. And, you know, and Matt Reeves needs to be mentioned as well. It was really Matt and JJ doing it together. They had a great bunch of directors, and sometimes they directed. So it felt like, even though the show never got the acclaim or the attention that like a Dawson's Creek got, we felt like we were doing something. This is the beginning of all of our careers and we're doing something really important. And I mean, just not important, like life changing, but just like, you know, important, like, I don't know, significant, I guess. And, so I just always went back to the writing because the writing was so good.
Yeah, I mean, it does feel like it's a show that's standing the test of time, which also speaks volumes. So many shows have existed in the history of television that no one talks about, that just sort of evaporate, even shows that lasted perhaps as long as Felicity. But I do think that, I mean, obviously the JJ and Matt Reeves component makes the show, and Carrie Russell and the amazing cast, like all of these things, it's just dated really well. And it's, you know, having done 20 episodes of this podcast on this show, we're now at the tail end of it. But, you know, watching it through the lens of 2020, seeing how well it holds up really speaks volumes to your point on the direction. You know, we've had Lawrence Trilling on here a couple times as well to talk about it. And just sort of, you know, it's an earnest show, but it's a show about good people trying to do good things and become better people and all that sort of stuff in a way that isn't treacly, and it doesn't feel like it's trying too hard. But it does stand up really well. It's still funny. It's still heartwarming. You know,
I think too, like it's, I think you know this too. It was being made by people who were good people and, you know, it's sincere, people who are doing it for the right reasons, and that trickles down. It trickles down from the top, you know.
It does, and I would also say too, you know, we as we record this in a pandemic and in an election year, we're in a very tricky time. And to be able to watch this show and not have issues with it says a lot too. I mean, this is part of a much bigger podcast where we do movies and we do music, we do all sorts of things, all the stuff that existed in '99, and I can safely say that a lot of it does not age well. You know, there's a good chunk of stuff where you just find yourself being like, oh God, like why did they have to go down that road? Or why did these characters do this thing or say this thing? And this show by and large really has very few hiccups. And that is a real testament to your point. Everybody involved wanted to make something good to put out into the world. And that is not, that's a rarity, sadly.
Totally. And, you know, it's funny. I remember 99 so well because of all these things that were going on. And I think just historically, I look back at that. I think, wow, that was, you know, 99, 2000 was really, I think about 9/11 as being the end of an era and the beginning of a new era, you know, and I look back at 99 and there was all this potential and, you know, the change of the century and, you know, all these things happening. And, It feels like it's great that you're doing this podcast because it does feel like a moment in time to take a picture of.
It's a very, it's a snapshot of a moment for sure.
Yeah. And so that year, so we finished the first season and I was his roommate and there was rumblings that would be sort of my move to sort of a higher position there. And then I got a pilot. I got a different pilot. And it actually shot in France, which again, they would never do that now, but they shot, we for CBS, we shot this pilot, this World War II pilot in France. And I was in France for like a month. and I came back and they were already underway at the second season, and our show didn't get, my show didn't get picked up. So I like sheepishly wrote an email to JJ and was like, hey, I'd love to come back if you guys will have me.
And that's then, amazing.
Yeah. And then slowly they brought me back in. So
it's really interesting, you know, having co-created a show, having been on staffs, people don't know how the sausages are made, and it's better off that they don't. Let them just enjoy the television shows for what they are.
Yeah.
But you know, I had Amy Smart on to talk about the Ruby character, and she talked about her run, but also, you know, she went off to do a movie and whether or not that might've had some sort of effect on why the character was eventually perhaps written off. Yeah. It's stuff like that where you're just like, it's a bummer because I think that, you know, Noel and Elena living together in season two has a lot of really fun stuff. But I think had Richard perhaps been a part of that trifecta, if it had been the three of you living together, seeing how those personalities might have bounced off each other, there's a lot of story that could have come from that, a lot of plot that could have come from that. Yeah. So it's disappointing, but at the same time, it's like, listen, you went to do your pilot and you should go to your pilot, and hopefully that would have gone and it would have been great. Like, and I'm sure no one begrudged that decision. Like, that's just what people do. It's the business.
Totally.
But it is definitely, it's, you know, it's an emotional roller coaster that we're
it
on.
It is,
in this,
man.
In this
it is. And you just kind of got to roll with it. And you know,
do.
And you don't have a lot of control over it, you know?
You don't.
No.
So I asked this question of Greg Grunberg when I had him on, but the characters have a lot of fun using your character. The writers have a lot of fun using your character as an agent of chaos.
Yes.
Did you enjoy that? Are you the type of person that likes to fuck with people, or is that just part of the fun of that?
I enjoy acting it a lot. I am not that guy because I'm not that guy.
Right.
I'm actually the opposite of that guy. Chaos makes me nervous. People make me nervous.
sure.
You know? And I'm actually sort of pride myself on being kind of a nice, I try to be a good person, a good guy. So to be able to have the keys to go, hey, go fuck with them. Go do whatever you want. You know what I mean? That was great. And like right now I'm on Supernatural and I do play the character God, which is, it's always weird. You ask me that question and I was like, I know. it's a weird thing to say because it's, it almost feels like it's being egotistical, but I turn bad. So I'm basically the big bad on Supernatural this season and God's kind of bad and it's cool what they're doing. He's like, he's riding the end of the show. God's saying it's over. Right. So, but people ask me like, how do you feel about playing the bad guy? And I love it. It's so fun because I'm not that guy.
Right.
So it's fun, you know, to have the permission
Absolutely.
To do that. So with Richard, it was that way. I loved being the guy that just completely caused chaos.
Yeah, I mean, it seemed like Richard obviously enjoyed it to a certain extent. I mean, specifically, there's the episode where he knows about Noel and Felicity, and he's using that to blackmail Noel. So he is getting to do things that he shouldn't be allowed to do, like installing a satellite in his dorm room, hand modeling.
Yeah,
sure. As I'm sure as one does.
Barbecuing.
Yes. All these things. It's great. That was a really great run of sort of that playing off of Noel and what have you. When did you and Scott kind of realize that there was a fun chemistry to the way that you guys played off of each other? Was it almost immediate or did it feel like?
It was almost immediate. He and I, we actually figured it out after I got the role and after we started working together that we had worked together at a restaurant. We were waiters together at a restaurant in Beverly Hills. It was the Carnegie Deli of Beverly Hills before it. Now it's not there anymore. But so we were waiters and we were like, so we kind of had that connection. And then, and also, I think he's from Missouri originally, and I'm from Missouri. We had that kind of connection. I think he's from Kansas City. Anyway, so yeah, we kind of had a connection. And I think it played in what we were doing. He's a great straight man. Like Foley is a great straight man.
Yes.
And so it just really worked. I think the writers liked writing for it and we loved playing it. Yeah, early on, you know, and as the series went on, same with Grunberg. Grunberg and I we had a chemistry. It was a different chemistry because we were both kind of funny dudes, but physically we're so opposite. We're like, you know, so we're kind of funny together. So they started pairing us together on stuff. And also our characters are similar in that we're both like schemers.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, you can. It's really, you know, when you're as lucky as the writers and directors were to have the cast of this show, where you know you can basically pair anybody off and you're going to get something good, mm-hmm. That's also incredibly rare. I mean, the bench is just so deep on this show, even with its recurring characters or even one-offs. Where I mean, I should know this, I don't know this, but who do you know who cast this show? Who was the casting director? Who cast Felicity?
Oh man. I should know that.
I didn't mean to quiz you. I'm sorry.
Whoever it is, I should know that. I think it was April Webster.
Okay. That sounds
April,
right.
Because April Webster casts all the JJ shows. So yeah.
It's a real testament to the casting directors and to put together these casts. I mean, you've been in pilots, you've been on other shows, you know how rare it is for the planets to align and for that chemistry to all kind of work. Totally. Is really, really special. So and that sort of leads to my next question, which was, you know, what was it like on set? Did you feel the sort of camaraderie that the show radiates, at least on the screen? Did it feel that way in real life?
100%, 100%. And you know, one of my favorite things to do, and I tell other casts this now because it just doesn't happen anymore, is after we block the shot, normally you go back to your trailer and you got 20 minutes while they light it, right? Mm-hmm. We would just hang out. We were just there. It was like, it was in, I remember scenes in Greg's apartment, in Greg Grunberg's character's apartment, and we'd all just hang out on the couches while they're sitting for the shot, because we just liked hanging out with each other. And, you know, Scott Speedman is still probably my best friend. I talk to him every day. And, you know, we're all still, Mandy's one of my best friends. Grunberg's one of my best friends. Like, I love those people. And it's because we, you know, it's like we were in college together.
You know? I was just going to say, you know, there's something about the fact that first and foremost, you see that on the screen, that the show has that hangout vibe of just wanting to hang out with these people. Mm-hmm. I think that lends to, you know, it's a low stakes show. You know, it doesn't have life and death stakes like so much television does. So you have to love these people and you have to just want to hang out with them all the time. At the same time, you guys are obviously older than the characters you're playing. So on mm-hmm. some level, there must be some joy in the nostalgia of being able to just kind of veg out like a 20 year old.
Yeah,
and not
but although in Hollywood, you know, when you're, I was 29. And I'm about 5 years older than like Speedman and Foley and, mm-hmm. and Carey. But when I was 29, I was still hanging out like I was 24. You know what I mean? Like we all age down a little bit in Hollywood, right?
Sure. Of course.
And now suddenly I'm turning 50 and I was like, what? I still in my body.
You don't look 50. But truthfully, it does feel like this town is, you know, if everyone could stay frozen at a certain age, they would. So I get that. What do you feel like the differences? And obviously these are two very different shows, but Felicity versus Supernatural, which are drastically dissimilar. Mm-hmm. You know, how do you kind of put your head into something that is deeply genre, deeply sort of, you know, obviously outside the norm and not grounded? What is that like in comparison to Felicity, which was, you know, literally hanging out in a fake dorm in Culver City every day?
Yeah. Well, you know, the set Supernatural is so great. It's really been the first show to come along since Felicity that I've felt a personal connection with. It's like a family. Because again, the show's been on for 15 seasons, and it's just finishing right now. It's crazy, and it's definitely different. Like you said, very genre. It only has two series regulars. It's really just about these two guys, and the rest of us are guesting on their show. But they're great guys, and again, it trickles down from the top, and they're really good guys. Eric Kripke created it, who's very JJ to me. They're very similar, I think. So it has some similarities, but acting wise, I think, like I said, you just kind of go, I still go back to the reality. I mean, like in these, you know, in like these episodes I'm doing this season, you know, I'm God being godly or whatever, but like, I still got to find some kind of reality to bring it back to. I still have to liken it to human emotions I have or lack thereof, you know, like, you know, I try to channel Donald Trump sometimes, you know what I mean? That it's that kind of egotistical, place that this character is in right now. But I try to come back to reality no matter what I'm playing. Supernatural is similar to Felicity in that we really like each other. Rather than hanging out on the set, we'll hang out in, you know, somebody's trailer. But
trailer,
we
do,
we still like hanging out together.
That's
now,
awesome.
Though, now it's so crazy because
I'm
just back up to finish the season. And I just went in to get sort of get my haircut and stuff. And it's bizarre out there. It's bizarre. Everyone's,
Have you started filming anything yet?
No, I start next week. Yeah.
I have... You know, obviously, I have a bunch of friends. First of all, I'm from Toronto, so I have a bunch of friends that are in Vancouver and Toronto that are sort of ramping up and getting back into production and getting into that whole thing.
Yeah.
And then you're seeing how they sort of film things now. It's weird. It's weird.
Yeah, it's different. First I'm going to be very get tested.
It's going to be very interesting to see how. 10 years from now, when we look back on stuff that was shot during this period, whether or not it actually looks any different, or if you could even sense any differences between the footage.
Yeah.
I mean, because it just feels like it's a strange time to be filming stuff.
Yeah, That's for sure. It's going to be interesting because we stopped on episode, we had two more episodes to do. So we stopped in episode 18, took this 5-month hiatus, and now back. Still in that same level of keeping it up here because it's the very, very end. In terms of playing both of these, the differences of playing these two characters, really, I just try to come back to what makes it real.
Right. So speaking of the ends of television shows, you're currently in the midst of ending this one. I got to ask about the end of Felicity and the time travel that existed. I just did a couple episodes on the final episodes and rewatched them for the first time since I saw them back in 2002 or whenever.
Oh, wow.
And they played a lot better now than they did back in 2002, just because in 2002, I think there was a lot of why is there time travel on Felicity? This feels very outside the norm of this show.
Yeah.
But having done this sort of deep dive into the series, it's actually not that completely insane.
Okay.
Megan's character kind of dips her toe into witchcraft in season one. So it's not, there are elements that kind of are there, but how did you feel as sort of, the show comes to a natural conclusion. They do your 17 episodes, which is what Warner Brothers asked for. Mm-hmm. And then they're like, just kidding, give us 5 more. Mm-hmm. Did you feel like it was like you had to emotionally get yourself to a place where it was done and then it went on for more and then you had to do it again?
Yeah. I remember specifically just being pissed because I wasn't in those episodes. For me, Felicity
you're in the very last episode.
But I'm in the last one. Which was great. And I remember that very clearly. But with the time travel thing, I remember not liking it because I wasn't in it. I did like it even more.
That's fair. Residuals, I get it.
Yeah. And I just like being with them. I mean, that was the thing. I like being around everybody. So when I was not in an episode, I was like, oh.
Yeah.
But yeah, I just wasn't in that. So I remember just being like, what is this? This is stupid. Doesn't make sense.
And Foley directs the first finale, if you will. He directs episode 17, which was the one that was supposed to be the last one.
That's right.
And then they asked for 5 more. And then, so you're there for the last, I'm assuming the last day of shooting, right? Which was the wedding.
Totally. Yep.
And Greg giving the speech to everybody. I spoke with Lawrence Twirling about the episode the other day. And he said that, he tried to do some blocking, tried to do some shooting, and he just wasn't feeling like that energy was there. And that's why he asked Greg to kind of essentially reminisce and bust everybody's balls and do whatever he did on Mike. Mm-hmm. And the reactions from all of you are so genuine. I mean, it's a stroke of genius on whoever's part of it's Lawrence or whoever to just sort of prop Greg up and say, do your thing.
Right.
But to get those reactions out of all of you, what was it like? Was it cathartic? I'm assuming that it was a very sort of blissful, nice way to end the show.
Yeah, it was. And it's funny. It was at that point, you didn't feel like you were acting anymore. At that point, we were just kind of being ourselves because, like I said, we all loved each other so much and had such a fun time together and had made all these memories together that felt significant. I mean, at this, 4 seasons isn't a long run by today's standards, but it felt like a lot, and it felt like we'd spent this, like I said before, this significant amount of time together. So yeah, I just remember
100 episodes isn't nothing.
Right. It's
100
true,
episodes.
It's a lot. Yeah. And we had, we remember it was at the, the Scientology Celebrity Center.
Okay.
Which is this big hotel building, odd building right near Beechwood Canyon. And they've got a huge gazebo. And so we shot the wedding in that gazebo.
That's so funny.
It was weird that we were there. I've got lots of pictures of that night. We were just hanging out. It just really just felt like we were hanging out. And Greg giving the speech didn't feel any different than Greg himself giving a speech like that at a rap party, you know?
Really? He likes to talk?
That he does.
I mean, I think I got two questions in my half an hour of talking with him.
Yeah, that makes sense.
I say that with nothing but love.
Oh my God.
It was fantastic. Yeah.
Did he tell you about the season that they didn't have as much money, and so they had to write into the show, I think season 3 when we did the shortened season.
Yeah.
It was short seasons. Yeah, and they didn't have we had a lower budget, so they wrote in these episodes where Greg and I are shooting this documentary. Yeah. And one of the reasons they did that is because they didn't want to spend the money on film. So we had this mandatory thing where we had to.
It worked though. It worked really well.
I thought it was super fun with me as his boom guy.
It's I mean, they do. So there's the documentary episode. Right. There's one of them in season 1, where and you figure into that as well, where you're trying to out Noel and Felicity and all that.
Yes.
And it had a very. I mean, I don't know if there's any legitimacy to Cloverfield having some semblance of coming from this, but the handheld footage, all of that sort of stuff, the whole episode is basically shot that way.
Yeah.
Now, there's no question it was for budgetary reasons, and I'm sure that episode was, you know, 2/3 cheaper than the previous episode.
Yeah.
So it worked. It was organic to the show, and that's again a testament to the fact that shouldn't work, but it works because the writers do it in a way that makes it feel like it actually would happen. Were you guys now? Greg said that like he wasn't allowed to actually film because of union rules. Were you allowed to actually record the audio?
I wasn't actually recording audio. I just had the prop. And he was right next to camera. So we had the actual cameraman and Greg is right next to the camera.
It's very meta. It's great.
Very meta.
That's awesome. Well, I mean, thank you so much for doing this. I really appreciate you coming on and talking, you know, going down memory lane.
I'm always happy to, you know, I'm always happy to talk about that show. And you know, like I said, I feel almost like it's a show that not everyone even knows about, but the people that do realize how special it was. And I always have to talk about it because it was very special to me too.
Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate
it. Thanks, Philip. 99 podcast like it. You want a podcast like it.
1999. Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.